From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made yesterday when Monroe County announced that another 32 people had tested positive for the coronavirus here. Of those 32 cases, 18 are under the age of 30. And that's been the trend lately. Just about every day, around half the new reported cases are people in their 20s or teens. It's hard to define any numbers during a pandemic as good. After all, 278 people have died from COVID-19 in Monroe County alone. We've seen more than 4,000 confirmed cases, and this afternoon, 65 patients are in the hospital, 6 are on a ventilator. But those numbers are much better than they were several months ago. They've been trending in the right direction. If this were the first week of September, schools would be green-lighted to allow students to return in person. That's because we're testing a lot of people, and the vast majority of tests are negative. Leading this effort has been Dr. Michael Mendoza, the Commissioner of Public Health for Monroe County. Of all the things that Dr. Mendoza has said since March, one thing has stood out to me the most. As WXXI prepared in May to host a televised forum on reopening the economy, Dr. Mendoza stressed that we can't get too fixated on the phases. Phase 4 didn't magically mean it's safe to go everywhere we want. And there's no day that he's going to be able to guarantee we can all safely return to our favorite places and activities. Yes, there will be phases of reopening. There have been. But as Dr. Mendoza says, the real determinants of success will be us, not the government. It's up to us. Are we wearing masks? Are we keeping appropriate physical distance? Are we resisting the urge to cut it loose and throw large indoor parties and ignore the guidelines? Now, everybody's fatigued here. I imagine Dr. Mendoza is especially fatigued, but we can't afford to let down. In this hour, we welcome Dr. Mendoza back to the program to talk about how we're doing and how we can prepare for the months ahead in this pandemic. Dr. Michael Mendoza, welcome back to the program.
Good afternoon, Evan. It's good to be back.
How tired are you?
Oh, tired is relative. Compared to March and April, I'm feeling quite rejuvenated, but the work is still there, and there's a lot to do, and this is really a marathon of unknown duration, and so that's how I've positioned it. I've worked with my team here in the health department, who I really believe are the true heroes of public health. But this is a long haul kind of situation, so we're just taking every step day by day.
Well, one of the great health writers that I've been reading for the last several months is Ed Yong from The Atlantic, among other publications, and he recently had a piece in The Atlantic called "The Health Experts Are Not All Right," and he talked about fatigue, burnout, but also the concern among the experts that the American public got to summer thinking this thing was mostly done in June and are getting hit with a hard dose of reality in July. Mm-hmm. And the question now is, as we look to the fall, winter, you know, can you hope that the public is going to be able to grind this thing out appropriately? Are you feeling decent about where we are as a community? Again, as I said at the outset, nobody feels good about 278 people who have died from this virus or all the cases. But, you know, we're in a very good position relative to most in this country.
It's true. And I guess I would characterize it as cautious optimism. You know, we've been through a lot, and it is no small feat. It's no accident, frankly, that we've gotten to where we are. I think it's due in large measure to the level of cooperation in the community, the level of patience, the level of desire to want to understand. And I don't want to take that for granted, because this is a long grind. And I get it when people say that they're tired of this. And to some degree, I think we all feel that sentiment. But, you know, the reality is that we've got to keep going, because we do not want to go back to those days where we were telling people to stay home, because that's not normal. You know, and that's not a message that anybody wants to hear. And that, frankly, wasn't a message that we wanted to share. You know, it was necessary at the time, but I think we've come a long way. There's a lot more we understand. There's still more that we don't understand. But I do think that as we go, into the next months, into the winter, to the extent that we can understand the risks, not just try to stomp them out, but understand them, I think that will go a long way toward allaying the uncertainty, the fear, all those emotions that I think are really very, very real.
We've got a number of questions from listeners already, and I will tell listeners, if you want to call the program with Dr. Mendoza today, you can do that. It's toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. The email is connections@WXXI.org. We'll get to some of those emails in just a moment here, but I will ask you, sort of generally speaking, I don't say what you need. I mean, you're a member of this community like anybody else, Dr. Mendoza. But I think what public health needs and what hospital staffs and doctors and nurses need if we're going to continue to be, you know, in a relatively good position against this virus for into the fall, maybe even into the winter?
Yeah, I think it's a number of things. Number one, I think it's information. Information has changed. And I think, you know, I take responsibility for the fact that we were sharing messages earlier on that we now wish we could have changed. But we were doing the best that we could at the time. And, you know, that's where we are now. We're doing the best that we are given the information that we have. But I think we all need more information. I think information is important. I think it will help us to make informed decisions. But the reality is that, you know, people want information to deal with the uncertainty. And, you know, when we began this, we put up our dashboard with all the numbers and the metrics and all of that. And I have been very impressed by how much interest there is in that dashboard, because I think people are looking for a thread of normalcy, of something concrete, something that they can hang their hat on and say, this is true. And, you know, the reality is there's a whole lot that's changing. And so information is one. The other is just conversation and connections. I think we want to have that ability to connect with one another. And the reality that we've got to connect in different ways is very unsettling. And so I think information, connections, conversations, I think those are the things that we all want to have.
What this county is doing with information on COVID is a model for the country. And I say that because I've talked to colleagues around the country in public radio and newspapers. I've tried to collect data myself, or at least compare data. It is not nearly as easy to find in many, many other places. Now, there's some states, some counties that are doing just as well, I think, but others where it's very difficult to get information. And listeners are probably well aware by now, but if they're not, as Dr. Mendoza points out, there's a dashboard, there's a daily afternoon update on how many new cases, exactly the age ranges, the genders, how many new deaths, updated information on how many people are still hospitalized and on a ventilator. I mean, that is really granular information. And why do you think that that has helped this community so much, Dr. Mendoza?
Well, I think, you know, given how much is changing, I think everybody wants to know that there's some transparency there. You know, we are not trying to hide anything. I mean, we want to be accurate. We want to share what we know. We want to be very frank with what we don't know. And I also think that as a health department, it's our responsibility to try to help people make meaning out of the numbers, because you can take numbers and create a whole lot of stories. And, you know, we have experts here in the health department who've been looking at numbers like this for decades. And our job is to help the public to make some meaning out of what we're seeing. Because, as I've said before, there isn't a single number, there isn't a single line on that graph that tells you in any given moment how we're doing. And this is an evolving picture. As the age ranges of the new cases has declined, as the numbers of people in the hospital has thankfully declined, as people have reopened, I mean, there are multiple moving targets to this situation. And so our job is to help give people some understanding in addition to the information.
So part of that information, as I mentioned at the outset, is looking at that age range. And it has been sort of macabrely fascinating to see that roughly half the cases in recent weeks, almost on a daily basis, have been people under the age of 30. 18 out of 32 new cases reported yesterday were people under the age of 30, and that has been the trend. And so, you know, that information can be very illuminating, but it also can be a little confusing. And when you and I talked back in May, you indicated that the tracing was partially responsible at that time for some of the increasing numbers of people who are diagnosed cases in their teens or even in their 20s. You know, in other words, maybe somebody in their 60s or 70s gets diagnosed. Mm-hmm. You trace and test family. You find more cases of asymptomatic people. I'm wondering now if this is the summer, if this is people who are out celebrating a bit, or if this is still a lot of the case of tracing. Do we know?
It's a lot more gatherings. As the economy, as the community has reopened, as we've seen restaurants and other venues reopen, it is not surprising to us that we're seeing more people in their younger decades coming down with the infection. And it is some contact tracing. You know, when we talk to a new case these days, on average, we'll see even up to 5 to 10 contacts per case, which wasn't the case back in April, where the average was really more like 1 or 2. Because people were inside, staying home, and so forth. But now that people are out, it isn't surprising that they're contacting more people. And so, you know, we are reaching out. We are making as many calls for, you know, people under quarantine now as we were in April, which is surprising to many. But I think that speaks to the fact that people are interacting more. And so that's not surprising. And the people who've been, you know, trapped in want to get out. I get it. It's summer. It's beautiful. You know, summer in Rochester is like gold. And people are doing what only is natural. But our advice, of course, is, you know, understand your risk and take precautions that make sense.
Well, we know a sizable chunk of our newly diagnosed cases are connected to travel. About a quarter of the COVID-19 cases diagnosed in Monroe County recently are essentially imported, according to the health department. Where are those people isolating when they do get here, Dr. Mendoza?
Well, we ask, you know, the vast majority of people who are bringing it back, if you will, are people who live originally in Rochester that are, you know, going out to Florida and to other states, you know, having, you know, whatever activities they have planned for the summer and then coming back with the infection. So in general, they're able to isolate at home, which is difficult. Let's just say that for the record. It is difficult to have to isolate at home. The notion of not being in contact with people is just unnatural. And yet so many of our young people and older people are doing it. And I think that's a statement of how much people want to help one another. But it is difficult. And so, yes, in general, people are able to quarantine or to isolate in their home.
And if local colleges and universities do come back to campus in this fall, and that is the plan among the vast majority of higher ed institutions in this region based on our surveying, that's thousands of potential out-of-staters who are coming here. Do we have the resources to quarantine them all in the case of, again, I use the word outbreak carefully, but just infection or clusters?
Well, our job in the health department is to really anticipate that. I think it would be very unlikely to get through that period and not have any, you know, small clusters of outbreaks, if you will, popping up at the various campuses. And so, you know, the local leaders of higher ed institutions have been on this all summer, planning for these, you know, days and weeks to come. You know, now that we have the travel advisories in place, I think everybody is pretty clear that waiting 14 days upon arrival makes good sense. How that looks, how people do that, it remains to be seen. But it can be done safely. And then once these students are here and here for 2 weeks, and once we get them to that transition, they're members of our community just like anybody else. And so we should treat them like, you know, differently than anybody else. And all the same precautions would apply to them as they would to anybody else. But it's getting through that transition period that will be tricky. You know, students will be coming in different, you know, time periods. So that is a part that we've been planning for, and the local higher ed institutions have been very cooperative with us. We're talking to them about how to manage this, you know, if and when it happens.
Is it likely to be quarantined in, for example, hotels off campus?
Well, it depends. So for the schools that have residential facilities, you know, we're looking really at the dorms for them to quarantine where they are. People who are coming to move into off-campus housing would be treated as anybody else in the community. But we're not looking to set up different facilities for them. I think, you know, we can quarantine people in their own home as much as we can to try to preserve whatever sense of normalcy that we can for them during that two-week period.
We know that African-American and Latino people are still dying from COVID-19 at higher rates across the country. And from what I do understand, based on the reporting of colleague Brett Dahlberg, it's maybe, what, 2 to 3 times the rate of white people in this county. Is that still correct?
That is true. When you age-adjust the data, it is true.
So if that's been that way for, you know, several months now, why is it so intractable? What is it about this disparity that we can't seem to sort of crack here?
Well, the disparity isn't new. I think to those who think that this is something new to COVID, I guess I want to say that this is not new. The disparities that we see in COVID are really only amplifications of disparities that we've known about for much, much longer. You know, we know that people of color are being exposed disproportionately to COVID-19, and due in large part to the fact that the physical distancing isn't something that is equally accessible across all communities. When you look at some homes where the average number of people per household is greater than in others, it shouldn't be a surprise that physical distancing is going to be much more difficult for some communities as compared to others. The preponderance of underlying chronic medical conditions has been longstanding well before COVID-19. And so the disparities that we see in those numbers are simply being amplified by this crisis. And so our job is to understand the data and to double down on all the things that we've been hoping to do and trying to do to try to eliminate health and healthcare disparities in our community.
Last question for me, and then I'm going to turn it over to listeners for the duration here with Dr. Michael Mendoza from the Monroe County Public Health Department. you're certainly, you know, correct to point out that back in March, there's so much that we didn't know, and we have learned a tremendous amount in the ensuing months here. Doesn't mean that we know everything. If there was one thing that you could know about this virus or this disease that we don't really fully understand now, what is it?
I wish I knew more about the preponderance of asymptomatic or presymptomatic spread. The notion that people can transmit this infection without any symptoms is very disconcerting to me, to everybody. It should be. And if we had a better sense of how common that was, what were the protective factors, what were the risk factors, that would allow me to take better steps to educate people about what the risks are. I think that's something that people want to know. Because at the end of the day, we can't eliminate risk. And I think that there are risks to staying under lockdown and staying at home and physical distancing. And I think people need to know the risks that they're willing to take and the risks that they're not willing to take. And the confusion around asymptomatic and presymptomatic spread is one that I think we need to learn more about. I think we also need to learn more about the prevalence of this illness in younger, under 18 individuals. Because as we reopen schools, the baseline prevalence of COVID in that population will greatly determine the extent to which we undertake precautions in our schools. And, you know, distancing in a school is going to be very difficult. And so we have to figure out how do we mitigate those risks, understanding that there are very real risks to schools not being open or to schools not being open like they were. So there's a whole lot that we still need to learn.
Yeah, and when it comes to schools, as I mentioned earlier this hour, if this were the first week of September, we'd be well within what the state guidelines have set for allowing reopening. The single most common question I've gotten for your appearance today is one that I will tell you, I will ask you, and you have no obligation to answer it. People want to know if you're going to send your kids back to school.
I am waiting to learn more. My goal is absolutely to send them back to school. But like every other parent out there, I do not want to send my kids back to school if I don't feel that the schools are doing so safely. I am very confident that the schools are working on creating a safe plan. But I want to assess, just like everybody else, at game time, what are we going to do? And I think we don't yet know everything. I think the plans are in the works. But what we don't know will be what's happening in the world, what's happening in the country, what's happening locally with the numbers. You know, right now our prevalence level is 2%. If school were to open tomorrow, absolutely, I would have no hesitation to send my kids to school. But we don't know what 2 weeks will look like. We don't know what will happen to the prevalence rate in response to the travelers coming into Monroe County. So I think, like every other parent, we just want to do the right thing for our kids and for our family. And I will make a decision for my kids as a parent at the time when we need to make that decision as to when they, you know, when we drop them off at school, when we put them on the bus.
By the way, was that a fair question or an unfair question?
Oh, there's no unfair questions from you, Evan. You'll ask all fair questions.
You'll text me after if it wasn't. I appreciate it. Bob in Rochester on the phone next with Dr. Mendoza. Go ahead, Bob. Are you there, Bob? You might be on mute, or you might be listening on terrestrial radio, which means he's behind. Are you there, Bob? I'll give you another second. I will ask Bob's question that he mentioned when he called in and talked to producer Megan Mack. He just wanted to know, I think, Dr. Mendoza, do we know how hot water has to be to kill this virus, and now do we have a better sense for how long it lives on surfaces?
I'll tell you, I don't know what parameters there are for the duration of this virus in water, in hot water. So I'll have to get back to you on that. What I can tell you, though, is that in swimming pools, anything that's got chlorine in it will essentially kill the virus on contact. So that we know. That begs the question, are swimming pools safe? The answer is yes and no. When you're in the water, underwater, you're absolutely safe from the virus. But when you're gathering outside the pool on the pool deck, all the same rules apply as far as distancing and so forth. As far as how long this lives on surfaces, the whole premise behind hand washing is sort of that, you know, there is definitely data that show that the virus will live on surfaces and can be transmitted to ourselves, and essentially by inoculating ourselves with unwashed hands and when we touch our eyes or nose or mouth. We also know that that's not the predominant way that this virus is transmitted. The predominant way this virus is transmitted is person-to-person respiratory viral particles that, are admitted from somebody who's infected, whether they know it or not, around 6 feet. We also know that that six-foot distance is longer if you're yelling, shouting, singing, or playing a wind instrument. You know, there are a lot of things that we think 12 feet is really what you need in, under those circumstances. But as far as living on the mail or on doorknobs or on surfaces, you know, it's really very low. Those surface, you know, those surface contact scenarios are really much more lower risk than we had thought, you know, several months ago.
I think that's some of the really good news that has come. And again, when we talk about that, it's not to share a false sense of security or for people to not take it seriously at all. I mean, I still touch almost nothing with my hands. I can open any door with my elbow, I found out. It's like a superpower. But that is a lot more comfort for people who, you know, when you go out and have to pick up groceries, things like that. Take it seriously, but maybe don't give yourself an anxiety attack. We're going to be okay here. Stu in Rochester next. Go ahead, Stu.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Dr. Mendoza, I wonder if you have any concerns about the fact that now the Trump administration is requiring all hospitals to report directly to the White House their statistics rather than going to the CDC, that the public will get accurate information?
I am definitely concerned that we have accurate information both as a public as well as local and state health departments. I don't exactly know how the information will be processed in the White House, but what I can tell you is that I want scientists to be looking at those data. You know, the CDC are the scientists who we have empowered to understand these data, and they've been doing this for a long time. So, you know, we need to ensure that we have accurate information out in the public. You know, the thought that, you know, unfortunately people made light of it, but it's unfortunate that, you know, we actually need to test more. You know, testing less is not the goal. We need to test more because that's how we will understand the true prevalence of this illness. And so having information, having data is paramount in this situation.
And we know that in the span of 3 days last month, Walgreens in Monroe County misreported the results of 8 coronavirus tests to the state database. So not a systemic issue, not a huge number, but something that's got people's attention. They submitted positive results for 4 people who tested negative and then vice versa on 4 more cases. Any concern about that?
Well, yeah, obviously. We want to make sure that people have the accurate information. My understanding of those situations was that ultimately the patients themselves got the right information, and that's good, so we had no harm done in the end. But absolutely I'm concerned about that because, you know, we need the public to trust the health departments, to trust my office, and anytime we have missteps like that, you know, I care because, you know, I don't take it for granted that the public has a lot of trust in our team here, and we need to keep earning that. And when we see missteps like that, I think it's unfortunate. You know, but when you put it in perspective, when you've had 8 of those out of how many thousands of cases, you know, it is rare, very rare. But, you know, I saw that and I said, we've got to do even more. Let's do everything we can to drive that number even lower because, you know, that trust is something you can't earn back easily. And so I take that very seriously.
And Dr. Mendoza, when Governor Cuomo recently said that this state will test anyone who wants to get tested, and he said everyone should get tested, do you agree with that? Do you still want people to think, look, symptoms or not, contact with people who've had COVID or not, go ahead and get tested at some point?
Yes, I do think people should get tested. What I do want to caution the public, though, is making sure you're interpreting the result correctly. So the most common misunderstanding that I hear is, I'm under quarantine. If I get a test and it's negative, I should be free. And the answer is no. Because what determines your needing to be under quarantine is the presence of a contact with a high-risk individual. And that you have a negative test doesn't change the fact that you were in contact with a high-risk individual. We know that in the first 4 to 5 days of illness, somebody who's got the infection, the first 4 to 5 days, their test is much more likely to come back negative than positive. And if it's negative, it's a false negative. And so that's a false sense of security. And we do not want people to walk away with a false sense of security because then they may inadvertently take risks on others that they're not aware about. And that's how the infection perpetuates. And so get tested, absolutely, and understand what those tests mean for you.
Sue in Fairport, next on the phone. Go ahead, Sue.
Hi. I hope the people coming back from Georgia, Texas, Florida aren't bringing an anti-mask attitude with them. my question is, what is being done to enforce, in terms of businesses, them requiring and enforcing entry to their businesses to people who are wearing masks? I know Walmart had a sign out saying that they required masks, but they weren't enforcing it, according to them, because they weren't the police. So even their nationwide claim that they're requiring masks doesn't mean much if it's not being enforced.
So thanks, Sue, for your question. That's a question that we get often. And I come back to what I think our role as a health department is, and it's generally not enforcement. Though we will do it, and there are instances when we have, and we are certainly considering the steps that we might need to undertake in order to enforce this, but I think the primary way we get people to do the right thing is by speaking up. I think the most powerful voice in the community is the voice of the community. And when everyday citizens reach out to the leadership at various businesses and supermarket chains and companies and establishments, I think that's the most powerful voice. I think, you know, when we can convey the message to the public that a business that takes the safety and health of its customers seriously is the one that we want to provide our business to, that will be a good day. And so reach out to the leadership at whatever store it is and share your thoughts, share your concerns, share your fears, because I think at the end of the day, business owners want to do the right thing for their customers, because at the end of the day, they want more customers. And in the health department, we take the same approach. We want to educate. We want to encourage people to do the right thing, because by and large, people are. And yes, we have instances, and we hear of many instances of where things may have been perceived as not being following the guidelines. And so when we get those complaints, we call. We call the business owner, and we let them know that we got a complaint, because I think most business owners who are responsible want to know, you know, get feedback from their customers. And we will remind them of what I believe they all know, but knowing isn't enough. It's trying to implement that, and it's not easy. You know, the store owner can't be in every corner of their store, but I think if they set the right tone, people will do the right thing. But this is a process, and you know, it's certainly not one that we're out of yet, but it's certainly been a big focus of us here in the health department.
On the subject of masks, here's an email from Lou in Rochester. He says, "My wife and I live in Rochester, but we are fortunate enough to winter in Florida. We returned later this year in early June. We noticed mask wearing to be fairly common most places that we stopped. When we arrived in Rochester, we were heartened to see virtually universal mask wearing, and that seems to persist now. Leadership from state, county, and city does make a difference. As for those who insist upon freedom from the oppression of wearing a mask, I say this. In 1968, my country asked me to wear a uniform and fight a war in Southeast Asia. Wearing a bit of cloth over your nose and mouth doesn't even qualify as a sacrifice." That's from Lou.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see here. And a different Bob wants to know, do we still have to wash our groceries when we bring them back from the store?
So we should always wash our groceries when, you know,
talking about
fruits and vegetables and all that, you know. But as far as, you know, cartons and boxes and things of that, paper, the most important thing you can do is wash your hands. You know, when you're storing these things, you know, it's good advice to wash your hands before you eat. It's good, you know, advice in general to wash your hands. But I wouldn't ask people to do anything more than that. I wouldn't look at the groceries and the reusable bags that we take to the supermarket. I wouldn't look at those as a major form of risk. I think the most important thing that we can do to reduce that risk is to wash our hands.
Tina in Rochester next with Dr. Michael Mendoza. Go ahead, Tina.
Hi. My question is, if I am asymptomatic, but I test positive for the disease and I quarantine for 2 weeks, mm-hmm. am I still contagious to other people after that? Does the virus stay with me forever? I mean, how long do I have to worry about infecting someone else if I do test positive but I don't have any symptoms?
Good question, Tina. So this is a very common and much more common scenario that we're encountering here in the health department. So if I understand your question correctly, you're asymptomatic and test positive. So technically, you're no longer quarantined. You're positive, so you should be under isolation. So quarantine is to protect people who might be at risk from to develop, you know, to follow them to see if they develop symptoms. That's for 14 days. Anybody who is confirmed positive is under isolation for 10 days, and as long as the last 3 days they're symptom-free and fever-free. So once you're a confirmed case, our department will reach out to you and share all that guidance with you. When we clear you from isolation, you are free to move about the county with the usual risks. Our belief now, although this is honestly changing, I think, as we speak, the question of reinfection is still an open one. But to date, we have not seen any confirmed cases of reinfection. Now, you will continue to test positive for weeks, well beyond when you're feeling well and when we've cleared you out of isolation. So testing positive doesn't mean you're contagious in that situation. But after 10 days and 3 days fever-free and no symptoms, we will issue you a clearance of isolation, and then you can go about your usual life as you were. But it is a complicated situation. This is one of those questions that we're still learning more about. Are people relapsing, or are people becoming reinfected? That's a question that we had a call, my commissioner counterparts and I, about how do we manage that, and is that a thing? So more to come on that one, Tina, for sure.
Does that help,
Tina?
Thanks so much. Yeah, Tina, thank you very much. Thanks for the phone call. Dr. Mendoza, on the subject of things that we are still learning about and still need more data about, tell me at least if I'm reading the latest research correctly when I read about viral load. Early on, there were a lot of questions about, well, how are so many nurses dying? Why are we seeing healthcare workers who are, you know, sort of young and vibrant? Why are they passing away in disproportionate numbers? The latest research I'm hearing indicates that this virus, like a number of others, not all viruses, but like some others, does potentially do a more serious infection, harder for the body to fight, if you are exposed to more of it in more concentration. In other words, if you sit down for 5 minutes with someone who's got COVID, you may get infected in a way that makes you asymptomatic if you're moving around and you get out of there. And your body is going to be able to handle a small load of virus. But if it's hours on end up close with people who've been infected and you're breathing in a lot of viral particles, that you'll have a heavier load and your body will be under a more stressful situation with the virus. Is that the latest understanding on this? Is that accurate?
That is accurate. That's one of the explanations, but it's not the only one.
Okay.
So what you're describing is what we call a dose response relationship. So the more the dose, the higher the response. I think it's fair to say that that is a good description for the initial infection. Your chance of becoming infected is greater the more exposure to virus particles that you have. But as far as how the body responds to that, that's an area that we're still learning a lot about. You know, early on, we were not as fond of steroids, even though in January I was thinking, just give them steroids, because steroids always work for this kind of thing. And, you know, that sort of fell out of favor, and then we're back around and everybody's getting steroids. So steroids, there is something about the inflammatory response that is important here. And, you know, is it the virus that kills, or is it the body's inflammation that mounts a response that the body can't handle? Is that what's getting people sick? So there's still a lot more about the physiology of actually getting sick and getting better that we're still learning about. But what you read is accurate up to a point as far as, you know, the initial insult. But again, there's still a lot more that we're learning about how to get people through this.
Maybe just that little bit of information, though, will be a good reminder to all of us that if you're feeling like, well, maybe one night out or going to a bar and being there for hours on end, just keep in mind the reason that physical distancing and these guidelines are in place. There's a lot of complex factors that we're still learning about here with Dr. Michael Mendoza, the Commissioner of Public Health for Monroe County. We've got a lot more of your phone calls and emails to take. Let's take our only break of the hour, and we're right back with Dr. Michael Mendoza. Coming up in our second hour, we're joined by a Brighton High School graduate who was named to Time Magazine's list of the 100 next leaders. That's because Toby Merrill went from Brighton to Harvard and then launched a project, Harvard Law School's Project on Predatory Student Lending. Now she's one of the leaders going after for-profit institutions that scam and cheat students. Toby Merrill, next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Joyce, next on the line with Dr. Michael Mendoza. Go ahead, Joyce.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead.
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, great. Two questions. One is, do you have any recommendations with regards to air filters and other equipment within people's homes that would be the best situation for us to keep COVID out. And the other has to do with the Monroe County Jail. I don't know if you are in communication with them or if you have any collaborative efforts going on, but I'd love to know how the staff are doing there and also the people who are currently living there are doing, and when visits and volunteer programs might begin again.
Great. So you've got two good questions, Joyce. First of all, in your home, the question about special filtration in your home. The greatest risk for this virus in your home are the people. The people that you allow into your home, whether they live there or are visitors. So the best thing you can do to protect your home is to protect the people who are coming into your home. And so the people who live in your home are going to be those of us. We've got to make sure that we do what we can to prevent ourselves from getting it on the outside. But then when you invite people into your home, and I'll tell you, in my home, we haven't had outside visitors in our home in months. All of the, you know, people that we've had visiting us in our home, we've had outside. So I don't think that changing our filters in our AC units is a wise step for us, because I've made the choice in my home to keep it restricted to the four of us who live there. So that, I would say, would be the first thing I'd offer as far as filtration. Now, when you're looking at, you know, larger venues, malls and gyms and all those, that it's a very different situation. So, you know, filtration matters much more there than it would perhaps in a private residence. And as to your question about the jail, yes, we are, you know, I'll say that the jail from the very start instituted very proactive steps. They were quarantining anybody who was new to the jail for 14 days upon arrival. So they took very aggressive steps very early, and we've seen very little out of the jails in terms of cases or even contacts because of all of the precautions that they took. That being said, you know, the jail population, they are struggling. You know, having interaction in the jail is difficult. And so, yes, we want to return some sense of normalcy there as well. But I will say that our colleagues in the jail have been very, very cooperative, very proactive on all the matters regarding COVID-19 transmission. So thankfully, we haven't seen very much out of the jails, which is a good thing.
Thank you, Joyce. George emails to ask, what is the status of a possible saliva test for COVID?
So the appeal of a saliva test is very obvious. You know, certainly it would be easier to obtain a sample than the current nasopharyngeal swab, which I understand, Evan, you've done before. And
oh, yeah, multiple times.
And it's not too bad.
No.
But the saliva test would be obviously much easier. The state of that, unfortunately, right now, is that there's nothing that's been validated well enough for us to be able to hang our hat on it. You know, with the PCR test, which looks for RNA in this case, the worry is the false negative. A false positive isn't really going to be a false positive. That we can manage that. But when you get a test and it's negative, that's where we worry in this situation. And the chance of a false negative with a saliva test is unfortunately unacceptably too high at this time. So there's a lot of research going into this, and a number of people in our community here in Rochester are involved in that research. But right now, the saliva test isn't yet ready for prime time.
Ray emails to say, I live in an apartment building where many of the residents refuse to wear face masks in the hallways. Is it the responsibility of the landlord to prod them to do so?
I would approach your landlord and bring up the concern that you have. I do think we all share that responsibility. You know, who has the legal right? I'm not sure. But I think we all have that responsibility as people in a community. You know, and I would say, to the extent that you feel comfortable, approach that person and say, you know, I feel more comfortable if you wore a mask, because, you know, in doing that, you would protect me in the same way that my wearing a mask is protecting you. But, you know, those are sometimes difficult conversations to have. But, you know, I'd encourage anybody to bring it up to anybody and just invite that conversation in a respectful and thoughtful way.
Here's an email that shows how much power Dr. Michael Mendoza has. Amelia in Rochester says, I'm engaged and I'm trying to plan a normal wedding. We've been planning for March of 2021. Every day I worry that March 2021 is too close and we won't be able to have a wedding with our family, with hugs and dancing. Should I postpone it? If so, how far out? If March isn't safe, then when? Late 2021? 2022? Should we give up on celebrating anything for the next few years? I miss having parties. I'm sad I can't even have an engagement party or a bridal shower to celebrate. Please ask Dr. Mendoza this for me. All right, that's Amelia.
Amelia, I'm with you on that. First of all, congratulations on your engagement. And the most important part about your wedding is the person you're getting married to. And that it shouldn't change. And the way you celebrate, unfortunately, might have to change a little bit. But the most important part there is celebrate however you feel comfortable. I wish I had a crystal ball. I wish I could know what day it would be okay. And unfortunately, I don't have that. None of us has that. You know, have been many weddings that have happened modified to a great degree, and that is tough. And I would love, and I've been invited to weddings, and I would love to be able to go like I normally would. But these are unfortunately very different times. So I wish you the best, and I wish I had a better answer for you on that one.
Sorry, Amelia. Hard spot. I know you're in a very hard spot there.
Yeah.
And you're not alone, Amelia. I can tell you that much. Let me read two emails that are similar here. Sandra says, Dr. Mendoza, my research indicates that 1% roughly of infected COVID-19 patients die from the virus, but I read that many people have lingering neurological problems and some are in a fugue state. Thank you for any input on this and for your wonderful data-driven leadership. And Beth says, what is currently known and what is being researched to treat those people who have had COVID-19 and are experiencing the lingering symptoms of extreme fatigue and muscle weakness that sometimes last for months? Are these patients heading toward chronic fatigue syndrome or other damaging effects of COVID?
Yeah, good question there. So first, on the 1% fatality, I think it's an incomplete story to just report the fatality rate. The burden of this illness, as you've mentioned, is more than fatality. Obviously, fatality is the one and outcome we want to absolutely avoid, but it's not the only story. And and 1% sometimes is made out to be, oh, it's not 2% or 3%. But when you look at 1% of the entire population, is a lot of people. And so I don't want to minimize this just because the number is 1 and not 2 or 3. But your second questions really have to do with the long-term impact of COVID-19. The chapter on that has yet to be written. We are seeing initially lots of people who are getting better quickly, lots of people who have never had symptoms, and then a whole lot of people who have very vague lingering symptoms for weeks and months. And they vary anywhere from chronic respiratory difficulty to muscle aches to general fatigue to the confused state that you're describing. I think I've heard that a number of times. Like I said, that chapter has yet to be written. And so that's something that we're learning about, which underscores the fact that we want to prevent this. And when people say, well, 20-year-olds don't tend to get hospitalized, and they certainly haven't died, and those are true statements. But that doesn't mean we want to just invite the infection and sort of allow this to happen, because we don't know what the long-term effects will be. We are essentially treading water until we have better treatments and a vaccine, but that doesn't mean we want to open the doors to risks that we don't yet know about. And so preventing this transmission, even among, quote, low-risk populations, is still really very, very important.
All right. Jacob emails to say, airborne COVID has 6 to 12 feet social distancing. In a vacuum, that is sound, but what happens when there are breezes outdoors? And how far does a good puff of wind scatter them? That's from Jacob. My understanding, Dr. Mendoza, is a light breeze is actually an ally because it can disperse viral particles.
Yes.
Is that wrong?
That is true.
That's right. Okay.
It's true. And being outdoors, we know, is safer. But I will say that among the recent cases that have been attributed to social gatherings, 90% of them occurred with outdoor, what we believe was outdoor transmission. So outdoors isn't 100% safe. It is safer, but it's not licensed to take unnecessary risks. Being outdoors makes it easier to have a larger gathering, and the number of people in a gathering greatly multiplies the risk. So, don't just assume that because you're outdoors, you can get close with people for a long period of time and take your mask off, because that's not true. But yes, there is something about being outside. We believe it's circulation that dilutes the concentration of those viral particles in a given person's airspace that is protective, but it's not 100% protective.
Elliot says, I've heard that a drop in oxygen level is one of the first signs of the virus. Do you recommend that I get an oximeter?
So it can be. So low oxygen can be one of the early symptoms, but that's not typically one of the early symptoms in younger people. What we've seen among younger people is this loss of taste or smell. It is something that we typically didn't, we don't typically ask that of people when they come in for a respiratory viral illness. That's not even a question we think about for influenza, but that has become sort of a hallmark symptom of this. And so, and that typically happens among younger people is sort of our experience. But oxygen level falling, no, I don't think everybody needs to have a pulse ox machine at home. I think your symptoms of how you feel, certainly fever, cough, the sensation of breathlessness is one that I think is very reliable. And then if you feel any of those symptoms, call your healthcare provider, and then they can take your pulse ox, among other vital signs, and give you an honest answer that's thoughtful and sort of takes into account all of those symptoms. But no, in general, I do not think everybody needs to have a pulse ox machine.
Don emails to say, Dr. Mendoza, you tweeted an article demonstrating that protests didn't seem to have much of an effect on COVID in June, but we still can't have large gatherings like festivals and parades, even with masks on here. What makes those different?
Well, so from a public health standpoint, a group of people is a group of people. You know, we are fortunate that the protests and the rallies and those larger gatherings didn't generate a spike in cases. My read of that is that in those events, people were generally passing by one another. They weren't stopping and chatting and gathering for extended periods of time. You know, we all saw the pictures. There were, you know, there was no evidence of physical distancing in any of those. And yet we certainly have not seen here in Monroe County, and I think it's been stated across the country, we haven't seen a surge in those cases. But then I think you have to look at it from a balance. You know, risk is just half of it. But what's the benefit, you know? And when you look at the benefits of protests and rallies, you know, we have to balance risk and benefit. And the need to communicate, to exercise our voice, to speak out against racism is very real. It does come at a risk right now. But, you know, we can't look at just benefit or just risk. We've got to look at the balance. And so that's what I want to encourage everybody to do when they step outside, you know, going to work, going to school, going to the, you know, to the store. What are your risks and what are the benefits? And to the extent that you're comfortable with that, that's important. But everybody's going to have a different comfort level with risk. And I think that's something that we've got to get used to. And we don't want to be shaming people who have a different perception of risk and benefit, because I don't think at the end of the day, shaming people is going to be an approach that will get us out of this crisis.
Peg in Irondequoit called in to ask, since the governor has reported that school openings and closures will be based on percentages, will the county's website start including that percentage info?
So the percentages that matter are what are being reported at the regional level. So the regional level will determine that sort of green light. And so those are currently being reported at the State Department of Health dashboard. And so we are pointing people in that direction to look at those numbers. But again, what I would say is by the time it gets to 5%, and, you know, that's the, you know, the minimum, we're in trouble. If we get to 5%, you know, we're going to need to have been doing a lot more before the number hits 5. And 9% is when schools would close. I hope we never see that, you know, because by the time we get to 9%, you know, once that number starts trending upward, it's going to be very hard to stop it.
And you're not talking about of total population. You're talking about what percent of daily tests are positive.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
So, for example, in Florida right now, it's 17%. Their highest number recently was 24%. Yeah. Those are massive numbers.
Yeah. The highest we saw here in Monroe County is 14%. But remember, that was early in the epidemic.
Lower number of tests.
Not testing.
Yeah.
Exactly. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Emily, who could be emailing on behalf of my mother. Love you, Mom. Please stay home as much as you can. That's an ongoing saga on this program. Emily says, I'm high risk. I've been alone for almost 5 months now. I guess my question is there anything safe for high risk people? And if not, how do we stay sane? That's from Emily.
Well, Emily, you speak to a very real fatigue, and pandemic fatigue is real. You know, nobody thought that asking people to stay home was going to go without any consequences. And we certainly didn't know how long it would last. You know, I think it lasted as short as it could, given how well this community has come together. But it's not to minimize the very real consequences of isolation and not having the interactions that we all, you know, need. So what can you do to stay safe? Understand your risk. Understand the risks that you're comfortable with. Going outdoors is safe. If you're going outdoors around other people, that increases the risk a tiny bit, but not that much. As long as everybody around you is taking precautions, certainly if you know who they are, you can attest to their having taken precautions, and you know, people that you know are certainly going to be more comfortable to you than people that you don't know. But as we learn more as a community, we'll be able to make that calculation for ourselves. And that's where I want us to get to, is to be able to understand that balance and to mitigate the risk, not to assume that we can make it zero, because we can't.
About 45 seconds, we've got a bunch of questions on antibodies. People asking, hey, in February I was sick. I really would want to know, is there a reliable antibody test, et cetera? How do we feel about antibody testing?
It's going to be very important that we have antibody testing. And unfortunately, right now, the antibody testing is not yet reliable enough to be able to say definitively if what you felt in February was COVID-19. And so we're not quite at that point. We certainly want to get to that point. That will allow us to change a lot of our guidance. But again, one more of those things that we add to the bucket of things that we're still learning more about.
Is that just because of the quality of the test, the number of false positives or false negatives?
Exactly. And we don't know if the antibodies that we're measuring are specific to COVID-19 coronavirus. They could be from other types of coronavirus, and so that would be a false positive. We don't know what the antibodies mean, if they're going to mean clinical immunity. We don't know how long they last. We don't know how much protection they might offer. So there's a lot of things about antibodies we're still learning about.
Dr. Mendoza, nobody's ever put my face on a donut, and they've put yours on a donut. And I know this community appreciates the work that you do. We probably could have taken questions all day, but we got a lot of listener questions, and I know you get them all the time, but you're generous with your time, and I do hope we can come back and do it again soon.
I look forward to that time.
Dr. Michael Mendoza is the Monroe County Public Health Commissioner. Not a whole lot of people would want his job right now, but there are a whole lot of people who are so glad that he's the one in that job. More connections coming up.